Welcome to the Pint and Click podcast. I'm Dave. I'm here with Joel and Tony, and it is a special horror Halloween podcast. We've got H.P. Lovecraft to talk about, and we've got It to talk about. The movies, the shows, the books, everything It. But we're going to start with H.P. Lovecraft. So H.P. Lovecraft, if you don't know, is a horror writer who wrote in about the 1920s or so, the 19-teens, the 1920s is when he wrote a lot of short stories. And so we read three of these short stories, The Call of Cthulhu, Dunwich Horror, and Whisperer in the Darkness. Guys, what do you think of H.P. Lovecraft?
It's eerie. At times it was a little overblown with its adjectives and adverbs and its trying to be weird, but I think that's a relic of its time and when it was published. I think it still holds up ridiculously well, considering it was written in the 20s. Mm-hmm. Highly entertaining, but I was going to say not for everybody, but I think everybody should actually check it out, because I think it's such a big staple of a lot of culture nowadays. A lot of it's based on it. So
I agree. It has a lot of archaic language, mm-hmm. And it seems, I don't want to call it formulaic, but it seems kind of formulaic, but I also agree that it is for a lot of people to discover. You know, if you have any inkling at all, if you like mystery, if you like any kind of suspense or horror, definitely Lovecraft is someone that, if you haven't read, that I would highly encourage people to check out.
Yeah, and even before we dive into any of these individual titles, I think one of the things that does amazingly across the things that we read was, like, you know, it builds this atmosphere, but it builds this world of, like, a reality within this fictional world where you're starting to kind of buy into it more and more the more they talk about it. So, like, just discovering texts and discovering, you know, academics within a society where there's, like, knowledge and hidden knowledge and forbidden knowledge and all this. So it's really good at creating that atmosphere, giving it more life beyond the pages that you're reading right in front of you. So it's...
Well, and contextually, when it was written, you know, World War I was a decade before. It just really shattered people's world views, and I think he's kind of channeling that maybe disillusionment into this writing. You know, like, things, you think things were bad, well, they could be so much worse with, you know, primordial ancient evil beings
sleeping beneath the ocean waiting to come back and all that. One of the things that really struck me about Call of Cthulhu, because that's the one, if you've heard Lovecraft, you've heard Cthulhu, and maybe you've heard of nothing else. But the story is written with so many degrees of separation. It's like I'm reading a story about a character who is reading a manuscript about an interview with another character who had gone to Louisiana and seen some things. And it's just like, who am I in this? Who do I relate to?
Yeah.
How is this scary? But somehow, like, I'm into it. I'm focused. I can't stop reading, even though there's no immediate danger. Like, I'm reading about a character reading a manuscript about some guys at a conference at a university. Like, there's no monster lurking over anyone's shoulder. But it kind of feels like there is. It kind of feels like there's a monster lurking over my shoulder, even though...
You're right. Yeah, it starts off like at the Hall of Mirrors.
Yeah.
You know, you see just a whole bunch of mirrors around, or a whole bunch of stories that are reflecting each other. But then it seems that the horror starts in the one part and then kind of overflows its compartment and gets to the bigger part, to the bigger part, until it finally starts affecting the main character himself.
Sure, yeah.
And he starts looking for his own stories and proof and whatnot. So it's, I agree with that.
It's kind of a bizarre take on horror, is to have something so, like, lifeless as a manuscript create a sense of dread. And he does that time and time again in these short stories. And that's really quite something. I do like, both of you mentioned the adjectives. The guy owned a thesaurus. There's no doubt about that, because there is every manner of, like, nothing is just that simple. Nothing simply exists. It must be a bizarre thing or a strange thing or an inside-out thing. I don't know. But every single noun seems to have an adjective, making it weird.
My favorite phrase is, I think I read somewhere, eldritch ululation, you know.
Which, what could that mean? I don't know, but...
Yeah.
So it's a primordial wail or something like
that.
But it just... Really, there are some parts of it where you just stop and you're like, this is Lovecraft condensed into this phrase right here.
This one sentence,
And usually involve the word demonic or, you know, something. But with the descriptions, great. He's got a lot of adjectives. Not a whole bunch of dialogue.
No.
And yeah, that's it's a good point. They're all like big blocks of print. Mm-hmm. And you almost feel like you can't look too far ahead because you're going to get overwhelmed, mm-hmm. that you have to chisel your way through. But then after a while, you get kind of absorbed in the story. Mm-hmm. And then if there is dialogue, it's colloquial. It's written how it's pronounced, and it's somewhat hard to read.
Yeah.
If not a little bit tedious to get through. But
so a little bizarre to read in the modern day. Because the rules that we have about, you know, use dialogue, show don't say, active voice, he kind of doesn't do those things. Mm-hmm. But it's engaging nonetheless.
Yeah, it is. There's like a certain texture to the words and the way he's saying them. When you compare the Call of Cthulhu to like the Dunwich Horror, the Dunwich Horror at least has much more of a, I would say, linear plot in narrative. Narrative. Mm-hmm. Something to follow, characters to follow, mm-hmm. more so than just the manuscript. So I was lucky because I started with that one. I feel like I would have been way more lost if I started with The Call of Cthulhu. I actually listened to Call of Cthulhu, so I think I missed something. I should probably go back and read it because there's so many names and weird words. Just it is kind of like poetry when you see some of those sentences together. But when you hear them spoken, it's really overwhelming, and you start becoming self-aware of like, what am I listening to? Mm-hmm. Because it's a mouthful. No one speaks like that.
Yeah,
you know. Whereas a lot of, I think even you pull any horror film or the Stephen King, you know, pull it off the shelf, and reading it is like hearing someone tell you the story a lot of times, because it's much more clear and to the point, mm-hmm. and minimalistic, whereas it just tends to be wordy, the Call of Cthulhu and stuff like that. But yeah, I really like the Dunwich Horror out of the ones that we read. I thought that bringing the problem to like a small town village, it was like an Appalachian village, gave it much more a sense of like, it was the mystery side of things. Like, you're kind of piecing these things together, and like maybe because of my history of knowing some things about Cthulhu, because like I said, it's like there's a lot of like references to what H.P. Lovecraft wrote about in all kinds of fantasy.
It's almost like his mythology he's created.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he keeps referring back to it.
Yeah. So even just knowing a little bit about that, the Dunwich Horrors is great because it kind of like slowly introduces these concepts of like what, and then you attach a little bit more into the characters, as wicked and strange as they might be.
The writing style in The Whisper in the Darkness, it comes out to a point where the reader knows what's going on more than the main character is letting on. And you're quicker to realize the danger of what's going on than the narrator is. And I think that's pretty effective because then it's like one of those things where like, don't go in there.
Yeah.
And don't you see what's going on?
Yeah.
That's what causes the unease and the tension, is knowing what's coming before the character. I mean, it's a classic, but for 1920s literature, it's pretty good.
Yeah, I think it's bizarre. Like, on the surface, it's bizarre, right? We're talking about ancient gods from beyond the stars or something like that. That's just a bizarre concept. But then, like, the way the stories are crafted are so different. The way the words are used are so different. Like, it kind of feels like you're reading an ancient manuscript yourself, because it's a writing style that's 100 years old. Mm-hmm. And so something about it has got this quality to it that I haven't experienced in other horror, in other writers. Like, I can understand now why people will read a story and just become transfixed with this author.
Yeah.
Because it's so unique and so effective at being creepy, at being scary, at being almost just like overwhelming dread sometimes. Just these ideas that the world will end some faraway day. But somehow the danger is real, even though, you know, it's not going to come today, it's not going to come tomorrow, but it's going to come.
The fear is there. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like getting a small glimpse of it, like the characters, too. I think you said it, like it's kind of comes off the page and engages your curiosity, too, to know. Because so little is really told to you. I mean, it gets really descriptive, but then so little of the great picture of what's out there is told to you. So I can see why, like, readers pick this up and are like, oh, I need to read more of this. It's not that huge a commitment to do a few more short stories, and then, you know.
Well, and definitely, if you track, I'm always interested in where did, like, if we read a bestseller today, where did that come from? Mm-hmm. And this is like a mile marker along the way of the horror story. And if you look at Stephen King and Brian Keene and these authors, and you go back, and you can trace a lineage all the way back to, I would think, that maybe the Edgar Allan Poe in the traditional horror sense, but he also started really writing detective stories that also created suspense and mystery. Mm-hmm. And I would even come up to Bram Stoker and maybe Jules Verne and H.G. Wells, because they were people who would push the envelope a little bit. And I think Lovecraft, if not maybe in the same line as those, he's part of the same evolutionary bush or tree of these authors. And I think he just went in a direction that I think Stephen King wound up, like today we're winding up with people like Stephen King. But if you come back a little bit, Lovecraft is definitely in there. His specific use of place names really helps ground you in the locale and the setting. And it really just kind of, it helps you picture yourself in that situation. And they know, you can describe your own area to somebody, and that's what this author is doing here. And again, one of the characteristics that really stands out to me about Stephen King is he does the same thing. He's got specific towns and placements, and it really helps you get into that world.
A point I want to make is that there's a lot of Lovecraft spin-offs or offshoots. Like, there's Lovecraft board games, there's Lovecraft card games that I play, there's Lovecraft-inspired video games. And if you love any of those things, definitely come back and read this source material, because one, it gives you some sort of context that just playing a Lovecraft board game you don't tend to get, and two, it's great if you like Eldritch Horror, the board game, where you're flying around the world trying to uncover clues about what's going on. Like, this is what the characters are literally doing in the story, is collecting clues from around the world or experiencing one terrible thing in one unlucky town. And it's so enjoyable to actually read the stories and recognize these characters somehow that I've never read before, but I've kind of experienced their story through these other games and through these other ways. I saw a very good low-budget film called The Call of Cthulhu that's in black and white. I saw, maybe came out 8 years ago, something like that. I assume Lovecraft is in the public domain, and that's how these things get made, because just a wonderful little movie that some diehard fans made. And I bought on DVD at Gen Con, and it's like another piece of this. I've been kind of circling Lovecraft my whole life and never actually landed and read the stories, and I'm so glad that I have now. So that's H.P. Lovecraft. If you come to the library, you can check out like collections of short stories that you can read on your own. Again, we read Call of Cthulhu, Dunwich Horror, and Whisper in the Darkness. We recommend it. I think we all had a lot of fun. Some of the stories are short, some are not so short, but they're all like certainly shorter than the author we're going to talk about next, which is Stephen King and It. We watched the new movie, we watched the old movie, we even read a little bit of the 1,000-page book. I'll start us off. So the new movie, It, came out maybe 3 weeks ago, and I thought it was great. I had a great time watching it.
Second year.
I also, not to mention, I watched the old movie, the TV show from the 90s, 2 days before I watched the new movie. So I was kind of scared to death that, oh, I'm going to be bored. I know what happens. I know what every character does and every story beat and all that. But still, the new movie really got to me, and it really had a strong effect. What did you guys think of the new movie?
Yeah, I mean, I saw part of the miniseries before and then finished watching the miniseries after watching the new film. And I can say that the new film, it took me by surprise. It was really good. And all I really knew going into from watching the miniseries, I was like, oh, well, I guess the concept is kind of like Stranger Things. And, it's kids running around a town and there's something that they're fighting. I never read It, and I still haven't read the Stephen King book. But you kind of see that the creators have such a respect and care for these characters and for the way the story is being told that they really, like, there's a lot of ways to interpret it. And that's what makes the movie and the retelling of it so good. It can take a totally different angle on a same character.
There's a lot of touchstones in the story, in the novel, in the miniseries, in the movie. And I was really pleased at seeing how everything was so different in those three formats. But there is always moments where they would have certain situations happen, certain things would happen, certain objects would appear.
Sure.
Maybe not in the exact way that happened in the story before, but it was there.
Right.
It's important that it's there. It doesn't necessarily matter how it happens. It's,
there's always Georgie in the boat. Although that scene plays out differently, there's always Georgie, there's always a boat, there's always a rainstorm. And how exactly that conversation goes is a little different. How exactly that scene ends is a little different. But everyone put their own little twist on what would be scariest, the scariest way for this scene to end.
Yeah.
Yeah, and also the white picket fence. that Ben is pushed against.
Mm-hmm. By the bully, Henry.
Henry Bowers.
Yeah, Henry Bowers.
You know, that's in all three. And it looks different in the miniseries as it does in the movie, and it's pictured differently in the novel. But that was the moment where I realized, there's always that fence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, there's always the fence he has to break through
to
get away, and that hill he has to fall down. And to me, it seemed reminiscent of, you know, on a normal day, you would break through a fence and fall down. That would be the worst part of your day.
Yeah.
But he was actually choosing that to get away from his situation.
From the,
and it's accentuating how, really, the story of it is about supernatural fear and supernatural power, but also about childhood and the everyday normal life horror that these kids that were visited upon these kids.
Yeah. And how they deal with it,
mm-hmm.
how they respond. Ben is obviously a target because he's the new kid. He's overweight. People pick on him and he just kind of endures it however he can. Whereas Richie in the movie theater, when the popcorn fell on the bullies, Richie stands up, takes a look, realizes he's in trouble, and dumps his soda as well. He's like, well, we're already in this.
Yeah.
We may as well commit. Like, he goes all the way. He turns it back around. And each one of these kids deals with bullying a different way.
Mm-hmm.
So there's bullying, and there's the stress of being in a new school for Ben, having no friends. Mike is homeschooled in the new movie. And there's, you know, the people of this town also are distinctly non-compassionate. Parents are, at best, hands-off. At worst, you know, you've got an overbearing mother, you've got an abusive father. Bill's father appears once, and he's angry, and that's it. That's all you get.
Right,
That's it.
Reasonably so, but that's the only experience of Bill's relationship with his father that you get is that, like, this is an angry man who is suffering very much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's that huge sense of loss. That's what his real life horror is, this gap in his family that he can't fill, and he's trying to fill it, and he's just not able to, you know, experience his mother or his father in the way that happened before Georgie.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And in the movie, there was a line that really struck me. They're about to go into this, you know, the scariest looking structure the whole entire film.
Mm-hmm.
And Bill says, I am less afraid to walk through this door than I am through the door of my own home.
Yeah.
And that rang.
Yeah.
That was huge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And all the different characters are experiencing different things, but they're all coming together and helping cover for each other. They're providing the family that their individual lives can't perform on their own. They can't receive on their own.
Yeah.
And they're looking to their friends.
And that line flips it. The conventional horror story trope is that it's the fear of the unknown.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in this case, Bill's not afraid of the unknown. He's afraid of the known. He doesn't want to go back home.
Exactly.
Like, that's scary, is the everyday life that I live with my family. That's what I'm afraid of.
Mm-hmm.
This I'll take head on because it's different.
Yeah.
And it's necessary, and it's asserting control over my environment. Whereas going home, I would have none of those things. I go back to being a bystander of this terrible loss.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get into what I think is going to be the fun part of the discussion. How does the old TV series from 1990 compare to the new movie of 2017? What do you think are the major differences?
There were some facepalm moments from the miniseries.
Yes, there were.
and it was the height of 90s chic.
Yeah.
With jean jackets galore and things like that. But they picked some really good actors and actresses to do these characters.
Yeah.
And even the kids.
Yeah.
You can see effort was being made. And Tim Curry as Pennywise.
Mm-hmm.
I was looking for, can I see Tim Curry in there?
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of can, but you kind of really can't.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that was fascinating.
Yeah. I loved the practical effects in the 1990s miniseries. There is a scene where Pennywise comes up from the shower drain, and I'm certain that scene was done, that effect was done with claymation.
Mm-hmm.
This drain becoming larger, large enough for a man to pop up through and say hello. That's amazing to me,
mm-hmm.
is that it's not CG. This is 1990. This is before CG took over everything. This is before Jurassic Park. That someone had to build a little model shower and frame by frame make this thing grow so that they could film this scene. I love just as a tangent now, I love 1990s practical effects. I love Judge Dredd with Stallone because that robot in the movie is a real robot. It's not CG. It's not, you know, a green screen with something artists put in later. They built a robot. It works on hydraulics. You know, that's awesome. And this movie had a lot of practical effects. Some a big deal, like the shower scene, but then the other ones, like when adult Richie, Harry Anderson, goes into the bookstore or whatever it is. The
library.
Is it the library?
Yeah.
And there's just balloons everywhere. Mm. Like, that was creepy. Mm. And it's just balloons, man. That's all it is.
Yeah. Right.
But something about that was super effective.
Yeah.
Bev in the street and the balloon that just stayed waist high and wouldn't float away. You expect it to float away.
And it was traveling.
And it traveled away down the from road. Her.
Exactly.
Yeah. That was creepy.
Yeah. There were a lot of those really interesting, creepy, weird moments. I like how you brought up the shower scene because I thought that the pipes coming out was really cool too.
Yeah.
Like I thought that was really just original and that they had that so well choreographed, it seemed, because there had to be people behind each one of
people
those,
behind
you know?
The wall grabbing a pipe and moving it in and out.
Yeah, so the effects are something that they must have spent. I mean, because you think about all of the encounters. There's just so much in that three-hour miniseries. I think that the new creation actually stands just because it's made to modern standards and it's not a TV, not to say there's anything terribly wrong with TV movies, but that there's more budget in a Hollywood film. It still has like a lot of those like jump out moments and a lot of those freak you out weird effects moments.
Yeah.
Not to say that they're bad or that they're done in too much excess, but I feel like in the original doing those, to me, it got tired after a while. Whereas in the newer film, it was a piece of the pacing and it helped to build the tension, even though they continually built the tension a lot in the new one. Mm-hmm. You know, they did a good job of keeping it funny, keeping it interesting. I mean, the fact that it's a clown really makes it, I think, rewatchable and initially terrifying. Mm-hmm. But then you're also trying to look behind the effects, too. You're trying to kind of see the trick behind it. Because a clown, it's supposed to only be frightening, right, to kids or something. But obviously, there's so many more things they can do with it. Like, for the 1990s miniseries, Pennywise, they do a great job of just the teeth and the camera work, just kind of like making it so that they're basically just zooming in on his crazy weird teeth.
Yeah.
And I think the soundtrack just lends itself, like everything about like the classic like horror soundtrack just kind of like crescendos and they don't linger for too long in any one scene. But then if you realize it is very formulaic and that it's like, it's going to build up, it's just going to scare you. He's just playing with his food at this point and we're going to move on to the next scene. So I felt like that's not a bad thing. It's actually kind of
Yeah. What's going to happen in this scene?
Yeah. What's going to happen
next? How is it going to happen?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how's it going to happen to this character? How's this character going to react? Mm-hmm. Is this character going to run away? Is this character going to fall down and into a fetal position? Is this character going to stand up and shout?
And the beauty of the three versions is that the character and Pennywise interactions are varied.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The one that happens in the miniseries is the shower scene for Eddie is completely different than in the book. Mm-hmm. And it's actually closer to the one in the movie. Mm-hmm. So it's... But they all work. There's no like, oh, I didn't like it because it's you just have to accept, you know, like artistic deviation or and you just kind of go with what the interpretation was of that. And you know, when you have different parts that you can interchange and move around and still have a successful narrative, that's a good story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's got a lot of meat in the actual narrative.
And the characters are so different, even though it's like seven young kids, all the same age, in the same town. They've all got their own problems in their own lives, and then they all have their own reactions to this threat. Some want to run towards it. Some want to run away. Some don't know what to do. I'm surprised that Stephen King initially was able to pull this feat off of having these characters so different from each other and blend so well together and succeed in all their own ways in conquering their fear. Mm-hmm. I also very much liked the young actors and actress in this new movie. I thought they were outstanding. I really loved Richie and Eddie. Those two guys had great chemistry working off each other because, you know, one was very anxious. So I think they're both very anxious, but one just kind of lets that anxiety out, and the other one just kind of sits back and mocks it, mocks his own anxiety.
He disguises it, yeah.
Right. And so then when Eddie's out there, like, I'm worried about this, I'm worried about that, Richie's all like, ah, that's silly, ah, that's dumb. Like, like, you know, when they're going through the, you know, Bill wants to go down the sewers and, you know, Richie's right there next to him and Stan's holding back and Eddie's halfway and like, how do I convince Eddie to come? Well, how do I convince Stan to come? Totally different arguments for totally different characters.
Right. And there's Ben in the background, always kind of the quiet leader, in a sense. In the miniseries and in the movie, there's exposures of people's weaknesses.
Yeah.
And there's revelations of people's strengths, and you see them all happen, and it kind of treats each character. There's really no lead. I mean, you know, there is a leader to the group, but there's no character supposed to care about more than the other. They're all treated very equally in all three aspects, too.
Yeah, Bill is introduced first, I guess, and that's like, is he the leader? No. Like, they're all kind of a leader. They're all a leader in different moments, too. Like, what one may run into in one situation and lead the group, the other one may run into in the other situation. Like we had just said, Bill's the first one to go down the pipe, but Richie's the first one to turn the soda onto the bad guys.
You're right.
Bev is the first to throw a rock when they're picking on Mike. Yeah. Right? The leadership revolves through throughout the group.
And Ben comes up with a dam.
Ben comes up with a dam, that's right.
It's a damn idea.
Yeah.
I think it all comes back to Bill a little bit. They give deference to Bill because of Georgie.
Yeah.
And they all kind of like, oh, you know, he's kind of paid the most in a sense. But I really got a sense of Derry itself. Like, not just the people in the town, but the actual physical locale of Derry is just poisonous. And in the movie, it's terrific. I loved it when at the picket fence scene and Ben and the car drove by and the people, the townsfolk looked at him and there's a balloon in the back seat. Kind of like marking, like it's inherent and it's just evil through and through.
Yeah, like the evil of indifference and the evil of like, you know, seeing this something going on and not bothering.
The lack of compassion.
Yeah, the lack of compassion, right? Well, not bothering to stop and slow down and see how your neighbor's doing.
Right.
Yeah.
Or the neighbor who sees on a rain-soaked street, she sees a boy leaning down by the gutter, and then she sees blood in the street and doesn't act.
Sure,
And there's also the scene when Georgie is with the boat towards the beginning, and you see the storm drain. The camera takes you towards it. You know what's coming. Yeah. And you're like, this is too close
I don't wanna go.
For me.
Yeah.
And it's like, you're coming with me. Yeah, you know, and it magnifies your own tension by zooming in at a certain, not slow, not fast, just your anticipation is just, I really appreciated that. I think that was a very subtle mark of the movie.
Yeah.
Going back to the Pennywise portrayed in the modern movie now, they did such a good job of making him more childish, choosing an actor that almost like, because you really don't get too much of his, from his eyes up, that's like his mask and his makeup. But I think from his mouth, you get the sense of he's like a child and he's hungry and he's playing with his food even more. And I think with the modern editing, they made it much more jarring when he's confronting the camera, you know, for that second person view or whatever, when you're from the vantage point of the one who's being attacked, the victim. And considering the technology they were working with at the time, in the 90s, they did an awesome job. But in this one, it's like way more jarring.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, that's creepy. That's like jump creepy, but it's also just they did a good job. Like they thought about it, about the way he moved.
Right.
To make it playful, I think.
And also in the miniseries with Bev and the sink, another touchstone, you know, her bathroom sink in the miniseries. It's just it's just like a food processor got you know, out of hand.
Yeah,
but in the movie, I really think they did an homage back to Carrie.
Yeah,
you know, just a nod towards another Stephen King novel.
That's exactly what I thought too.
And I was just stunned.
Yeah,
I love
like,
that.
I can honestly see why someone would be traumatized by this happening.
Sure.
Yeah.
Fantastic movie. $266 million so far. It is a success. It is the fifth highest grossing movie of the year. We enjoyed it a lot. If you had to choose 1990s or 2017, which one did you prefer?
2017.
Yeah. Really? I'm going 1990s. I like that.
Well,
I like Tim Curry. I can't let him go. it's great. It's an A movie. I give it an A, the 2017 movie, but Tim Curry was my Pennywise. I did watch this when I was, oh, who knows,
me too.
Like
me too.
9 years old or whenever it came out.
I was 13, 12 years old. But yeah.
Nice.
I would like to point out that in the miniseries, the principal of the school appears a very short time, but I sat bolt forward. I was like, is that And it's William Davis, who plays a cigarette-smoking man in the X-Files.
Okay.
You know, if you're a fan of the X-Files, you know that there's behind every conspiracy or closed door, you open it and it's filled with cigarette smoke, and you'll see the ember of a cigarette going on, and you'll see the bad guy smoking it. In the new movie, I flipped out because the grandfather of Mike Hanlon is Steve Williams, who also played in the X-Files for a few seasons.
Oh, yeah?
And he was an informant. He would pass information on to Fox Mulder.
Sure.
But he played a deep government role as well. And I wondered if that was... No, they were filmed all in Vancouver.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The X-Files and this new movie. Mm-hmm. And I don't know where the miniseries, but it possibly could have been there as well. But I wondered, is there a connection? Did they see that? Did they have a... Mm-hmm.
Was it a coincidence hiring local actors? Or was it, did someone say...
We had this guy...
We have an X-Files connection that we need to pay off in the new movie. I don't know. Just announced on Twitter, they're making an It Chapter 2. I don't think that's a spoiler to say that there's another movie coming. Mm-hmm. I am delirious with excitement to watch next one in 2019.
Yeah, it's a horror movie I can say I'm going to pursue watching, which is pretty rare for me.
Pretty rare for me, too. Yeah. Absolutely. This movie made so much money. I hope they just get the highest paid actors and actresses they can possibly get.
Yeah,
I want to see Idris Elba as Mike and Tom Cruise as Bill or something like that. I don't know. Who's the most expensive actor you can think of. Put him in this new movie. That could be a lot of fun. Yeah. I don't know if they'll do that. Maybe I'm...
Matt Damon involved in there somewhere.
Matt Damon is Ben. Yeah, I was just thinking. He's a perfect Ben. Like Ocean's 11, right? Just get that exact cast back. And put...
It's just such a terrific story, though. And more of like the... One more thing I want to point out is the bike. Bill's bike of the Hi-Ho Silver. Mm-hmm. It's almost even more than a touchstone. It's a talisman. Mm. Everything is okay when the bike shows up.
It's the one good and pure thing in the town. It protects him. It has a payoff at the end.
You're right.
It's the beacon of hope in the bottom of Pandora's box, maybe. It's like there's one thing in this town that's good, and it's Bill's bike. It's silver. You got to have that, I guess. You got to have something.
We got to have hope.
You got to have hope, You got to have trust.
Going back to the whole childhood thing, you can encounter uncertainty and struggle with self-discovery and identification, but as long as you have the hope that it's going to turn out okay, you can keep going.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So if you want to watch It or you want to read It, put some holds, man, because they are popular at the library. We have the miniseries on disc, and we have several copies of the book, but they are going. And so come in and put your name down.
They take a long time to circulate because it's a tome.
Yes, it is 1,000 pages.
It's a three-hour miniseries, too. Uh-huh. So don't forget to flip the DVD over if you start when they're all adults, like I did.
Like I did that, and I watched it all the way through. Yeah. We got to the end, and my wife and I are like, this isn't right. We missed this scene. We missed that scene. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, we watched the second half first, which is okay because we had both seen it before. It didn't ruin anything for us, but... Yeah, do be careful with that double-sided disc.
Because I didn't know there was a whole plot as children that I was missing out on until I rewatched it as a kid. But it's okay. It was all explained in the movie.
So. And the new movie is in theaters now. Go check it out. If you can't make it to theaters now, we'll have it sometime next year on disc at the library as well. All right, that is it for the Pint and Click podcast. Happy Halloween, everyone, and we'll see you next time.